Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 5th of February, these are our main stories. Around 100 people have been killed in forest fires in Chile amid warnings that that number could rise even higher. The US says its airstrikes against Iranian-backed militants in the Middle East have been effective, but insists more attacks are still needed. Voters in Paris have approved a plan to triple parking fees for people from outside the city if they drive SUVs in the French capital. Also in this podcast, why Lionel Messi was booed by his own fans. Central Chile is on fire. Wildfires are sweeping through the region of Valparaiso amid an intense summer heatwave and prolonged drought. The flames have been devouring forests and houses on hillsides overlooking towns. As we record this podcast, around 100 people have died, and there are fears that number could rise further still. These people living in the coastal town of Viña del Mar have lost their homes.
From one moment to the next, the fire reached the botanical park. In 10 minutes, the fire was already on us. There was smoke, the sky turned black, everything was dark. The wind felt like a hurricane. It was like being in hell.
We need help. Food for our pets, supplies, clothes. I don't know. My house. I lost everything. Everything.
Well, as firefighters continue to battle the blazes, President Gabriel Boric has declared a state of emergency. In a nationwide TV address, he said rescuers were doing all they could to save lives.
We have said it and we repeat it. Today's priority is to save lives, as there are still active fires. Assist the injured people, and as quickly as possible to quell the active fires that are now being battled.
Graciela Ibáñez is a journalist who lives in Viña del Mar, one of the worst affected towns.
Friday afternoon was crazy. We could see a big smoke all over the city. And it was a sunny day and very windy too. So you could see the contrast between the smoke and the sky, the blue sky. And it just turned worse and worse over the hours. Now it's a little bit calmer, thank God.
And had those wildfires reached the outskirts of the city?
Yes, part of the city has been burned. Some 25% of the urban area of the city has burned. And neighboring municipalities like Quilpué or Casablanca also in the Valparaíso region, which is a coastal region.
So houses have been destroyed. People have been made homeless.
Yes. There might be some 5,000 homes destroyed in Viña del Mar. That means around 12,000 people without homes. And because it's summer, people are on vacation, so there are no kids going to school. There are a lot of tourists right now in the city. And the local people are being helped by the local government and the central government too.
So what's being done to fight these wildfires?
So there have been firefighters from the city and neighboring cities. There are also other fires in the country. This is the season, unfortunately. There's been a lot of help from fire departments from around the area and from other cities. Today, the day was more humid, colder, so that has helped to decrease the fires.
You say this is the season for wildfires. So are
yes.
These spontaneous, or are there suggestions that some of them may have been started deliberately?
The governor of the Valparaíso region said the fires were intentionally caused. And the same thing said the superintendent of the Valparaíso Fire Department. So they're going to pursue legal actions to identify these people.
You've also got the El Niño weather phenomenon. I just wondered whether the climate was changing in Chile.
Yes, yes. So we're in the dry season, but this dry season has been longer than usual. So the air is drier, less humid than it should be. So all of that is contributing to the expansion of the fire.
Graciela Ibanez speaking to Julian Marshall. The White House National Security Advisor has said the US will press on with its retaliation against Iranian-backed groups in Iraq and Syria and Houthi fighters in Yemen. Jake Sullivan told American television that airstrikes against the Houthis had reduced their ability to attack ships in the Red Sea. Mr. Sullivan also said the US might carry out further strikes in retaliation for the deadly attack a week ago on US troops in Jordan when three US personnel died.
It began with the strikes on Friday night, but that is not the end of it. We intend to take additional strikes and additional action to continue to send a clear message that the United States will respond when our forces are attacked or our people are killed.
Funerals have been held in Baghdad after 17 people were killed in those U.S. strikes. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports from the Iraqi capital.
In Baghdad today, a fleet of ambulances carry those killed by the U.S. 17 fighters from militias backed by Iran. Officially, they are part of Iraq's security forces, but in many ways, they are foot soldiers for Tehran. The U.S. strikes have caused anger here, the government saying they have threatened the security of Iraq and the region. A red line was crossed by targeting our forces, says Falah al-Fayyad, leader of the militias. This must not be repeated.
Allah, Allahu Akbar, America, Shaitan
al-Akbar. And the chant from the crowd, America is the greatest devil.
Allah, Allahu Akbar, America, Shaitan.
They want U.S. forces out.
These men have come to mourn and to honour their dead, victims of American bombing raids. But there is also a message in all of this. It's a show of strength, a show of unity, and a warning to the United States. We are here, and we're not going anywhere.
But the mood was muted, and there were no fiery threats of retaliation. Iran doesn't want an escalation in the tit for tat. Neither does Washington. While the war rages in Gaza, one false move could set the region alight.
That report by Orla Guerin. Meanwhile, Egypt says revenue from the Suez Canal plunged by almost half in January. The constant Houthi attacks since November have forced major shipping companies to avoid the waterway. Electra Naismith has this report.
Egypt says income from the Suez Canal last month was just under $430 million. That's down from $800 million in the same period last year. The number of ships is also down by more than a third. It's a sign the Houthi attacks are affecting not just commercial shipping, but Egyptian coffers. Suez is a vital source of foreign income, raising more than $10 billion last year for Egypt's already teetering economy.
Electra Naismith. Voters in a referendum in Paris have approved a plan to triple parking fees for people from outside the city if they drive SUVs in the French capital. Sales have soared for SUVs and pickups, much higher and wider than the average saloon. Socialists and Greens in the French capital say when parked on the city's narrow streets, these large vehicles make it difficult or even impossible for other cars and bikes to squeeze by safely. John Lawrenson reports.
On Paris's pretty left bank, in a narrow street called, rather wonderfully, Rue Madame or Mrs. Street, a giant white Volvo XC90 hybrid glides noiselessly into a parking space. Well, I say in, the back end is more out. Inside, a young mother and her 10-ish-year-old son. She gets out and asks me if I know where the nearest parking meter is. I say, funny you should say that, and we get talking. New charges will apply to fossil fuel cars over 1.6 tonnes and e-cars over 2 tonnes, so she will have to pay. She says the charge is unfair because she doesn't really have a choice.
We didn't get this car to drive in Paris, which I don't do very often. but because we have big dog, so for long journeys we can't take the plane and it's difficult to take the train. This is our way of travelling.
I mentioned this lady when, on the steps of the Opera House in one of the areas where Paris traffic is densest, I meet up with Tony Ronucci, executive director of the anti-air pollution non-profit Respire, Breathe in English. They always have an excuse, he mutters. He thinks this referendum is a great idea.
It'll be a very strong and powerful signal to car makers to tell them, stop doing SUV. Now you have to focus on smaller and electric vehicles.
Down in the metro, which is how, says Tony Ronucci, people should get around. But Philippe Nozière, president of a non-profit called 40 Million Motorists, says this is not always possible and that this referendum is fundamentally unfair.
Comme d'habitude,
as usual, Mayor Anne Hidalgo is getting Parisians to vote. But Parisians mostly don't have cars, and when they do, won't be made to pay higher parking charges if they stay in the district where they live. It's people who live in the suburbs, who don't get to vote in this referendum, who often need their cars to get into town, and who will have to pay this tax.
Mayor Hidalgo has already drastically limited the space given to cars in this town by cutting street parking places and extending cycle and bus lanes. She's limited access to the city for older, more polluting cars, increased the price of car parking, introduced parking charges for motorised two-wheelers, and imposed a speed limit of 19 miles an hour on most roads. For people out on the streets of Paris, this new measure is either, pâtisserie metaphor time, the cherry on the cake, or takes the biscuit.
I think it's fair. I have a big car. I always have things that need moving, plants, trees and so on. So I need my SUV. But if you have a big car, you have to bear the consequences.
I am in favor of letting people live their lives when it comes to things like this. Leave people in peace.
Residents of Paris speaking to our reporter, John Lawrenson there. Now, this is a sound that football legend Lionel Messi doesn't normally hear from his own fans. But that was a reaction he got in Hong Kong when fans who'd spent days eagerly looking forward to their team's match with Messi's club Inter Miami were instead treated to the sight of him sitting on the bench. Some of them demanded their money back.
I've been a Messi fan since I was very little, and it really hurt me tonight. I was very excited to see him play. It was going to be my first time ever seeing him play.
We're very disappointed. I wish I didn't come. Like, we came for Messi, and Messi wasn't here.
And you can't do this to the fans.
Yeah, I wish we didn't come, and I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us how Messi mania turned into just a plain mess.
This was a really much anticipated match. Tickets for this game had sold out within an hour back in December. And everybody was looking forward to seeing Messi. He plays for Inter Miami, team in the United States, but it was him that they'd come to see, essentially. On Saturday, thousands of them had gathered at the training centre just to watch him train. Some fans had also gone to the hotel. Real kind of mania, football craze in Hong Kong. They turned up. He didn't play at all. He spent the whole match sitting on the substitutes bench and people were getting quite angry towards the end and kind of chanting, saying they wanted their money back, a refund, demanding that Messi get up on the pitch and play. So they were quite angry about it.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Because at the end they were booing. They booed the co-owner of Inter Miami, David Beckham. What's Inter Miami's explanation for the fact that Lionel Messi didn't even make a cameo appearance?
Essentially, they said he was injured, so the coach came to try and assuage all these fans who were angry at Messi not appearing, saying he was injured. They're on a big pre-season tour at the moment. They played in Saudi Arabia a few days ago. I think he only had a few minutes there. They're then going on to Japan and then back to America, where the season, the football season, begins again later on this month. So presumably they want to get him fit for real competition rather than just a pre-season exhibition matches. But of course, if you've paid hundreds and hundreds of dollars for tickets, which some people have, some had even flown in from Australia, from other parts of China to come and watch this match, That's not something that an excuse that you would necessarily be happy with.
You'd want that excuse before the match, not after it.
Yeah, if you watch some of the promotional video before, the team, when they arrived at Hong Kong Airport, there was a photo shoot with them, Messi's there in the middle, and on billboards across Hong Kong, you see adverts for this match. There he is, Messi, front and centre. Even a junk, a traditional Chinese sailing ship in Victoria Harbour in Hong Kong, had sails with Messi's face on it. So obviously the implication is that he's going to be here. He's going to be playing. So, of course, fans are quite angry. They want their money back. And incidentally, the local authorities in Hong Kong, who've given about $2 million in sponsorship, they're saying that they might want their money back as well.
Mickey Bristow. Still to come. The Russian cosmonaut who's just broken a world record.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
I'm Una Chaplin, and from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service, this is Hollywood Exiles. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. On Sunday, a day after Senegal's president suddenly called off this month's election, just hours before campaigning was due to begin, protests erupted in the capital, Dakar. Police fired tear gas at demonstrators and carried out arrests. Some opposition leaders have expressed their concerns that the president is trying to illegally cling on to power. Khalifa Sall is a presidential candidate for the coalition Tarawu Senegal.
Never in Senegal's political history have we seen a situation like this. It's a dangerous precedent. To be able to postpone a presidential election on the eve of its start is unprecedented.
The US and the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, have called for a new date to be set as soon as possible. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more about the protests.
Not huge in size, but possibly a sort of warning of what's to come. Not just young men, which is usually the demographic for the kinds of people that get out on the streets and express their anger at the politicians. This time, men and women of a variety of ages. Some of them set up barricades, sort of setting fire to tyres, clearly angered by this decision to postpone the elections. And then the police responded with tear gas and dispersed the crowds, chased some of them and made some arrests. We've heard that Aminata Touré, who's a former prime minister and now opposition figure, she was arrested, and as was one of the presidential candidates, Anta Babacar Nguem. So we are expecting more protests. There have been some called for Monday outside the parliament, and I think this is just sort of taste of the kind of anger that is likely to swirl around now in Senegal.
Has the president explained his decision to call off the election so suddenly?
Well, he says it's all to do with this political dispute over who's allowed to run in the election. Many, many candidates put their names forward, and then judges from a constitutional council ruled out many of them for a variety of reasons. 20 were allowed to go through. But of the people who were blocked from running, there's, for example, Karim Wade, who's the son of a former president, Abdoulaye Wade. He was deemed to be a dual national and so was blocked. So he actually tried to get the election postponed. So basically, this suggestion that the judges who were deciding who should be on the ballot paper did the wrong thing and didn't do it in a proper way, that's led to a political row. And Macky Sall says he's postponed it so that it can be a calm and free and fair election.
Will Ross, to an extraordinary story now from Baltimore in the United States and an impressively close, life-saving mother-daughter relationship. When 71-year-old Julia Harlan's liver began to fail, doctors told her she needed a transplant as soon as possible to save her life, but because of her age, was unlikely to get one. Her 39-year-old daughter, Eileen, stepped in to find out if she was a match for her mother,
but that was only the beginning of what turned into an extremely rare double transplant. Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to them. First to Eileen. Did she tell her mother that she was being tested for a transplant?
No, so I didn't. She had always said, I said initially when we knew she needed the transplant, I was like, oh, mom, I'll be your donor if I can. She's like, absolutely not. So a month or two had gone by and she was just in excruciating discomfort. And it took probably 4 months for me to complete everything. It's like an extensive amount of blood work. I felt so relieved to have it done and be a match. I was smiling ear to ear. I was so incredibly happy.
And then you had the business of telling your mum and dealing with her reaction. How did that go?
I knew I was going to be seeing my mom that Sunday for Mother's Day. So I sat down with them and I told them, and I know her and my dad started crying and it was emotional.
I mean, I was in shock, to tell you the truth.
You must have felt very loved, though, to know that Eileen had gone through all of this.
Definitely.
So tell us about that operation, because this is a seriously involved, quite dangerous operation, I think, is it?
Right. And it's quite long, too. They said I was in ICU for 2 or 3 days or something.
Eileen, how did you feel after that operation?
I looked to me like I was 9 months pregnant. Like I was so swollen. My belly was so big. Because when they cut you, they cut under your breastbone all the way down past your belly buttons.
So what listeners won't possibly know yet is that this was only the beginning of the story, because after this, there's a whole nother operation that has to happen. And this time, Julia, you needed a kidney.
It came out of the blue. I had just passed my 1 year anniversary from having the first transplant. And my coordinator from my liver transplant, she called and she said, your creatinine score is going up. And they finally came up with, oh, you need a kidney transplant.
So this is where Eileen comes in and comes to the rescue.
Again. Yes.
Because Eileen, you donated one of your kidneys to Julia. Was that a difficult decision?
No, two of my other siblings did try to apply for the kidney, and they unfortunately were not matches for her.
And so the recovery for that?
We were out of the hospital in 2 days. I mean, it was significantly easier than the liver, for sure.
Did any of your siblings or wider family members have worries about this, or have they all been supportive?
I think that they were nervous, for sure, but I was determined to do it, so I wasn't listening. I didn't care. I love her, and I'm so happy to have more years with her.
Eileen and Julia Harlan there. Now, this might make you feel old. Facebook celebrated its 20th birthday at the weekend. It's grown from a network for Harvard University students to one of the biggest online platforms in the world. But as concern has grown about the way it operates, for instance, making vast profits from harvesting our personal data or being used as a political tool in elections, there are growing calls for its influence to be curbed. So, after 20 years, is Facebook seen as a force for bad or good? Lauren Taylor's been discussing the influence of Facebook with Fred Turner, a professor of communication at Stanford University.
I'd say that Facebook is, to the last 20 years, what television and radio were to the previous 100. The impact has been extraordinary. It's been a leading social medium. It arrived with the promise that it would bring us a world of global interconnection, kind of the promise of a global village. And in fact, it's brought us challenges to democracy, the acceleration of rumor. It's fueled revolutions. It's had an enormous impact.
Things have changed, haven't they, with social media? Because sometimes it's about what we choose to look at, but sometimes it's also driven by algorithms, isn't it? How much difference does that make?
Well, the algorithms are very important, but they're really driven by the business model. And the business model is keep people on the site at all times, at all costs. That's what algorithms do. Algorithms are designed to track your behavior, follow what you're doing, and give you more of what you want. And that tends to produce kind of spirals and filter bubbles within which a person can get kind of locked.
Tell me about the way Facebook might play during an election year. I mean, in the past, obviously, these things have had an influence. But how about now? Does social media and places like Facebook really make a big difference when it comes to elections?
They make a very big difference. They make it in two ways. One, they make it at the kind of individual level. You know, when you go on social media, you are in some sense alone, but you're in a world where there are lots of other folks talking to one another, where there are folks trying to manipulate your opinions, and where you're trying to seek information that confirms the biases you already have. That's a human trait. We're all going to be doing that. At the same time, we're going to be living in a world where state actors, non-state actors are trying to influence our opinions. And Facebook is the royal road for propaganda. You can set propaganda machines on fire in Facebook in ways that transform people's opinions. And it's a pretty powerful mix.
Where do you think it's going for Facebook? What would you predict for the next, say, 10 years?
There's a lot of talk about how Facebook as a company is not holding on to younger users and younger users are going elsewhere. I think they've been extremely savvy about buying up firms like Instagram and integrating those into the larger enterprise. So I think Facebook's going to be with us for quite a while. I may be the last one to say it, but I think Facebook is the Chevrolet or Ford of social media.
Professor Fred Turner. A Russian cosmonaut has set a new world record for the most time spent in space. Oleg Kononenko, who's months away from his 60th birthday, clocked up a cumulative total of more than 878 days outside the Earth's atmosphere, the equivalent of nearly 2.5 years, breaking the record held by another Russian cosmonaut. With more on his gravity-defying achievement, here's Madeline Drury.
59-year-old Oleg Kononenko first blasted off into space in 2008 and did so again and again and again, accumulating his world record across 5 different missions. He's still up there after his current trip to the International Space Station launched last year.
I am proud of all my achievements,
he said in a written interview with the Russian news agency TASS, which we have voiced here.
But I'm more proud that the record for the total duration of human stay in space is still held by a Russian cosmonaut.
At the end of this trip, Kononenko is expected to bring his total to over 1,000 days in space.
It is only upon returning home that the realization comes that for hundreds of days in my absence, the children have been growing up without a papa. No one will return this time to me.
But how about the record for longest time spent in space in one go? That achievement is held by another Russian cosmonaut, Valery Polyakov, who spent 437 continuous days in orbit between 1994 and 1995. Among US astronauts, the record is held by
Frank Rubio, the US record holder for the longest single spaceflight in history, back on Earth.
As captured on this live stream from NASA, Rubio clocked up 371 continuous days in space, 6 months longer than he had intended on spending up there when his spacecraft got a leak in 2022.
Easy, easy.
The International Space Station is one of the few projects that Russia and the United States work on together, a unique oasis since Russia's invasion of Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. Russia's space programs are currently grappling with funding shortages and corruption, although President Vladimir Putin has said he'll turn that around.
Russia had blasted a man-made moon into outer space.
Kononenko's achievement is a world away from the early years of the space race, when the Soviet Union became the first to launch a satellite to orbit the Earth with Sputnik in 1957, captured in this archive from Periscope Film.
The Soviets had scored a scientific first.
That report was by Madeline Drury. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Hewitt. The producer was Alison Davies. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time. Goodbye.